Coming up, Lucky Severson reports on the violent oppression by Buddhists of the Muslim minority in Myanmar. Plus, for Easter, Kim Lawton talks with Catholic priest and best-selling author James Martin about why he believes Jesus' resurrection is central to the Christian faith.
Without the resurrection, the Gospels just fall apart.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us this week of Passover and Easter. Western and Eastern Orthodox Christians have been observing Holy Week with a series of special services. In Ukraine, many churches celebrated Palm Sunday with additional prayers for a peaceful resolution of the crisis with Russia. Pope Francis presided over several traditional rituals, including the Holy Thursday foot washing service, which he conducted at a rehabilitation center for disabled people in Rome. There he washed and kissed the feet of 12 people, among them women and non-Catholics. The season of Easter, or in the Eastern tradition, Pascha, is considered the most important time on the Christian calendar. Jews around the world have been celebrating Passover, the 8-day holiday that commemorates their ancestors' exodus from slavery in Egypt. Jews held special meals, seders, where they retold the Exodus story. Here in the U.S., many Jewish centers heightened security in the wake of the fatal shootings at two Jewish facilities in Kansas last Sunday. A former Ku Klux Klan leader with well-known anti-Semitic views killed three people in his shooting spree. The three victims were all Christians. Frazier Glenn Miller was charged with murder, and the Justice Department is investigating the incident as a possible hate crime. Religious groups strongly condemned what many called this senseless act of violence. Participants at an interfaith memorial service Thursday urged new unity in the wake of the tragedy. President Obama denounced the shootings at his annual Easter prayer breakfast for Christian leaders, which was held at the White House on Monday.
We've got to stand united against this kind of terrible violence, which has no place in our society. And we have to keep coming together across faiths to combat the ignorance and intolerance, including anti-Semitism, that can lead to hatred and to violence.
This week, the president also hosted a Passover Seder at the White House for staffers, family, and friends. And on Tuesday, he met with a small group of religious leaders in the Oval Office to discuss new strategies to push for passage of comprehensive immigration reform, which has been stalled in Congress. Prayer services and other somber ceremonies were held in Boston this week to mark the one-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings. The full day of memorials included a wreath-laying ceremony and a moment of silence to honor the victims. The alleged perpetrators were Muslims, and this week, U.S. Muslim leaders announced a new initiative to combat religious extremism. The Muslim Public Affairs Council, or MPAC, unveiled its project to help Muslim communities intervene in the lives of those at risk of being radicalized.
If a young troubled individual has problematic thoughts and ideas and is moving towards a path of violence, there are places where you can stop them through theological help, through mental health services, through family counseling, and this is what the Safe Space Initiative is about.
MPAC also joined other Muslim groups in welcoming a decision by the New York Police Department this week to disband a controversial unit that spied on Muslims. Islamic groups have long protested the post-9/11 unit that kept records on the daily lives of Muslims, and infiltrated mosques and student groups. Muslim leaders said disbanding the unit was a step in the right direction, but they expressed concern that the NYPD might start other discriminatory surveillance programs. The U.S., European Union, Russia, and Ukraine hammered out an agreement this week that attempts to de-escalate tensions in Ukraine. The plan calls for pro-Russian militias to surrender government buildings and urges all sides to refrain from violence. It also condemns all expressions of extremism and religious intolerance, including anti-Semitism. Still, many officials remain wary. Secretary of State John Kerry emphasized that, quote, words on paper are no substitute for action. In Syria, more intense fighting this week as government forces stepped up their offensive on rebel-held territories, including an ancient Christian town along the Lebanese border, Mallula. A number of historic Christian sites were significantly damaged in the fighting, including a Greek Orthodox monastery dating back to the 4th century. The Syrian conflict has driven millions from their homes, and the UN projects that Syrians will soon surpass Afghans as the world's largest refugee group. There's a terrible contrast in this week's news. Holy days celebrating resurrection, freedom, and hope, alongside brutal outbreaks of hate and violence. One more tragic example. Lucky Severson was in Myanmar recently, the former Burma, and sent us a report on the continuing persecution in one part of that country. Mobs of Buddhists have been violently attacking the Rohingya Muslim minority, and no one seems to know how to stop it.
Violence in Myanmar, also known as Burma. Rohingya Muslims being burned out of their villages and driven out of their country by mobs of Buddhists, which sometimes include monks.
The police stood aside, the army stood aside.
Phil Robertson is with the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch.
Entire areas were burned down. I mean, we had satellite photographs before and after showing the damage, that people were being shot and killed, people were being disappeared. We uncovered mass graves from that period of time. It was a slaughter.
They gathered like 4,000, 5,000 people, and then they surrounded the village. They attacked the Muslim.
Ko Ong, a made-up name, is a Rohingya refugee who still has family in Myanmar, so he is afraid to be identified.
They used the spears, knife, and also arrows.
Matthew Smith is the Asia Director of Fortify Rights, an international nonprofit that documents human rights violations.
Many of the crimes that we've documented rise to the level of crimes against humanity. These are some of the most serious crimes that can be committed under international law.
United Nations officials say the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar's Rakhine State are one of the world's most persecuted minorities. They are stateless people, citizens of no country, treated as if they are illegal immigrants, even though many families have resided here for centuries.
They cannot move, they cannot walk, they cannot study, and they cannot even marry. They are trying to make a law for the restriction of marriage and for the restriction of having the children. If they cannot have citizenship, if they cannot have medical treatment, how can they survive? They will disappear. Their race will be disappeared.
There has long been bad blood between the Rohingyas and the local Buddhists, but it boiled over in 2012 after Rohingya men gang-raped and murdered a Buddhist woman. At least 300 Rohingya men, women, and children were murdered by angry mobs, and there have been episodes of violence ever since. At least 140,000 have been driven out of their homes.
There's a fear among the Buddhist population, among large segments of the Buddhist population in Myanmar, that the country is at risk of being taken over by Muslims. It's a very unreasonable, irrational fear.
Especially considering there are fewer than 1.5 million Rohingyas out of a population of about 60 million. 9 out of 10 citizens of Myanmar are Buddhists. Almost all young males spend some time as a monk. It's considered an experience that will set them on the right path. Buddhism is known as a way of life or a religion that promotes inner peace and harmony. So why the violence and oppression in one of the world's most Buddhist countries?
The government is actually actively involved in promoting this idea that the Rohingya population poses a threat to national security. This is something we hear very often, and it infuses all of the violence that's taking place right now.
Sitwe, the provincial capital before this violence, had a demographic balance that was roughly 50-50 between Buddhists and Muslims. Now, with the exception of one quarter, which is almost like a ghetto, Sitwe is a Muslim-free city. Everybody has been driven out.
One monk in particular is behind the violence. His name is Warathu, and he is known as the Burmese Bin Laden. He's a leader of a group called 969.
Many of the leaders of 969 and followers of 969 refer to Muslims as dogs. They refer to the Rohingya as subhuman. But beyond that, they actually believe the Rohingya are subhuman. I think this is an important point. It's not simply that they are stirring up some sort of rhetoric for political purposes. These are people who genuinely believe the hateful rhetoric that they preach, and I think this is one of the things that makes them particularly dangerous.
Many Buddhists are unhappy with the extremist monks and do their best to protect the Rohingyans. But it's not a subject that the Burmese speak of openly. Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Prize laureate, an opposition leader, has refused to take sides, saying it could further exacerbate the tension. The Dalai Lama spoke against the violence, but to no avail.
They basically told him to mind his own business. It was really actually quite a put-down. They're not prepared to listen.
Last year, some 80,000 Rohingyans crowded like livestock into small boats to escape Myanmar, often at a very high price.
They sent the boat that carried 58 people. 25 of them died on the way.
These young men, now hiding in a mosque in southern Thailand, were among the fortunate ones to make it here alive. They prefer to be nameless. They were tortured by their smugglers and traffickers, detained in a Thai illegal immigrant camp, then wound up back with the traffickers where, among other forms of torture, they were forced in a crouch position for so many weeks, they can't walk standing up.
You know, they have to pass through Thailand. And this is where we see these smuggling camps, these people being held, being beaten while they're holding the phone, calling their relatives.
They're given a cell phone. They're told to call their family. And they're told that they need to raise $2,000 in order to be set free.
An average Burmese earns about $800 a year, so $2,000 is a lot of money. We obtained a tape of a phone conversation between a representative of Fortify Rights and a refugee being held by traffickers.
Are you okay? How could I be okay? My skin is peeled off from beatings. Thai guys came in and beat us because nobody transfers money for us. Would you please collect money from the others and transfer money? Please.
They know the risks of dying at sea. They know the risks of experiencing violence from human traffickers and from the authorities, but they're willing to take that risk because the situation is so bad in Rakhine State.
Robertson is discouraged that it has been 20 years since the UN set up a system to prevent another Rwanda.
The problem is we keep saying never again, and it keeps happening.
Buddhists and other religious leaders can condemn what's happening here, but can't stop it. Human rights activists say only the government can stop the violence, and if it doesn't, it could descend into genocide.
The international community has been, in some ways, intoxicated by this narrative of political reform in Myanmar over the last couple years. And in the interest of not wanting to disrupt that idea of reform, most governments are treading very softly around the government when it comes to its human rights record. And this is the wrong approach entirely.
Unless the international community acts and acts with some consistency and with some immediacy, we could face a much worse situation in Rakhine State in just the coming months.
These young Rohingyans still have not made it to a country that will accept them, wondering if one ever will.
So now we don't have any hope. Almighty God will know what will happen in the future.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Myanmar.
There is one small possibility of help. The Prime Minister of Malaysia to the south has said Rohingya Muslim refugees who make it to Malaysia will not be sent back. On our calendar this week, Baha'is around the world celebrate the festival of Ridwan. The 12-day holiday commemorates the Prophet Baha'u'llah's announcement in 1863 that he was the new messenger of God. And, of course, as we noted, it's the most important season for Christians, Easter, celebrating the resurrection of Jesus. Prominent Roman Catholic priest James Martin has a new book out called Jesus, A Pilgrimage, which has been on the New York Times bestseller list for the past month. The book combines historical and theological perspectives about Jesus with Martin's own spiritual insights. Kim Lawton spoke with him about why he believes the resurrection is central to the Christian faith.
For Christians, this is the most sacred time of the year, a time when they reflect on some of the key events of Jesus' life. Yes, he lives. Events that shape their core beliefs.
The story of the Passion, Death, and Resurrection, especially the Resurrection, which we commemorate during Holy Week, is at the center of a Christian's faith. Really, it's the Resurrection that changes everything. Yes, he lives.
Roman Catholic priest and best-selling author James Martin believes the Easter season provides Christians with fresh opportunities to explore what he calls one of the great mysteries of the Christian faith, the teaching that Jesus was fully human and at the same time fully divine. Some scholars and authors focus exclusively on the historical Jesus of Nazareth and others on the Christ of faith. Martin's new book, Jesus, A Pilgrimage, tries to bring the two together.
If you leave out the historical considerations, it's as if Jesus is sort of God pretending to be a human being. And if you leave out the miracles and the resurrection, it's just this man pretending to be God. So he's fully human and fully divine. And if we lose sight of either perspective, we really misunderstand and misinterpret who Jesus was and is.
And Martin argues that in order to fully understand Easter, Christians need to consider both perspectives.
People who only want to focus on Jesus' humanity will see in Holy Week just the suffering, right? Because it's all about Jesus, the human being who suffered, which is true. But if we leave out the resurrection, the story doesn't make any sense, and really the story is kind of meaningless. And people who only want to focus on the Christ of faith and only want to focus on the resurrection leave out the sufferings and the very human things that the human Jesus went through.
We're up here on the top of the Mount of Olives, you can see.
Martin's book draws in part on insights from a recent pilgrimage to the Holy Land. He says he could vividly imagine Jesus as a real person in real places, such as on Palm Sunday, when Jesus entered the gates of Jerusalem to the cheers of crowds who were waving palm branches.
Palm Sunday is very bittersweet because when Jesus and the disciples enter Jerusalem, it's to these great crowds who are rejoicing and welcoming him as Messiah. And so, in a sense, it's kind of his triumph. But the Christian knows that in another week, he'll be crucified. So he goes from kind of the top of the world to really just being rejected.
On Holy or Maundy Thursday, Jesus instituted the practice of communion, the Eucharist, which Christians regularly reenact in worship services. But at the same meal, Jesus also washed the feet of his disciples, something many Christians commemorate only once a year.
And it helps us move into the other events of Holy Week, particularly the crucifixion, by reminding us what Jesus is doing. Everything he's doing is out of a sense of service and humility. And so, in a sense, that prepares us for what is about to come.
After the supper, according to the Bible, Jesus and his disciples went to pray in a garden called Gethsemane on the Mount of Olives. Scholars believe the general location of the garden is the same today as it was 2,000 years ago. Martin says the story shows Jesus at his most human.
One gospel translation said that he collapsed on the ground in prayer. Not that he kneels on the ground, but he collapses on the ground. And he prays, he says, remove this cup, you know, meaning I don't want to die. I don't know if I can deal with this. But he has to pray three times before he comes to understand that this seems to be what the Father is asking of him. And interestingly, when I was in the Holy Land, I realized that the Judean wilderness is just a few hundred yards away. He could have easily escaped, but somehow he decides and believes that this is what the Father is asking him, and he says yes.
Martin says the rituals of Holy Week help connect Christians more fully with Jesus. Throughout the season, and especially on Good Friday, many pray at Stations of the Cross, which remind them of the path Jesus took to the crucifixion.
So this station is Jesus being nailed to the cross. And while a lot of Christians focus on the physical sufferings of Jesus, which were intense, I mean, crucifixion was probably the worst way to die, there are other ways that Jesus suffered that I think Christians can connect to. So the feeling of abandonment, Jesus is not only abandoned by his disciples, but he feels at one point abandoned even by God the Father. Betrayal, one of his closest friends betrays him, and loneliness, simple loneliness. So a lot of the emotional sufferings that Jesus went through are also ways that Christians can enter into Jesus' life.
In Jerusalem, Christians reenact the path to the crucifixion along the Via Dolorosa in the Old City. Historians may question the authenticity of some of the locations, but Martin says for many, it's a profound spiritual experience.
We meet Christ in the middle of our regular lives, and we suffer in the middle of this sort of crazy, chaotic world. It's not something that just happened 2,000 years ago. The suffering and the entrance into the Passion is something that happens every day for us.
Martin says for him, the most meaningful stop was the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the ancient church built over the site where tradition says Jesus was crucified.
One of the most powerful experiences I had in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was walking up a staircase to go up to the hill of Golgotha. And when I was walking up, I thought, this is the same incline, this is the same rise that Jesus walked up. And I felt myself to be very unworthy to even climb those stairs.
Also inside is a spot where many Christians believe Jesus was buried.
One of the things that dawned on me when I was at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is that it's not just the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, i.e. Jesus' tomb, it's the place of the resurrection. And I thought it was kind of funny, actually, that Christians called it, you know, basically the Church of the Tomb. I think it should be called the Church of the Resurrection.
Martin calls the resurrection a message of unparalleled hope and unparalleled joy.
Beyond just the simple fact, and it's an amazing fact, that Christ is risen, it means that God can do anything, that life is stronger than death, that love is stronger than hatred, that hope is stronger than despair, but most importantly, nothing is impossible with God. And that's what I think Jesus proclaims as he comes for us from the tomb.
He acknowledges that for many people, the concept of the resurrection can be difficult to accept.
I always remind people that there are certain what you might call proofs of the resurrection. The disciples move from being terrified to being ready to spread the gospel at the risk of their lives. And frankly, only something as vivid, as dramatic, as real as the resurrection could affect that change.
He also notes that the gospels say the risen Jesus first appeared to a woman, Mary Magdalene.
New Testament scholars say that if the gospel writers wanted to kind of make this up, if they were making it up, they would never have picked a woman because at the time, women were seen in that culture as not particularly reliable witnesses. And so, in a sense, it's a kind of proof, if you will, of the gospel's authenticity.
Ultimately, Martin says, it's a matter of faith, one central to Christianity.
You know, a lot of people like to think of Jesus as just a compassionate prophet or a wise teacher or even a healer. But they stop short when it comes to Easter Sunday. But you must accept Easter Sunday if you're going to be a Christian. It's the whole point of the story. The fact that he died, even in a noble way, really doesn't tell the whole story. And without the resurrection, the Gospels just fall apart.
And he says that's why billions of Christians around the world celebrate Easter Sunday. I'm Kim Lawton in New York.
Finally, have you voted for us yet in the Webby People's Voice Awards? We've been nominated for the prestigious award honoring the best work done on the web, and you can help us win by voting for us online. The deadline is this coming week. We've produced a helpful video to guide you on how to vote in just a few easy steps. It's on our website at pbs.org. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. Happy Easter and happy Passover. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our Webby-nominated website, where there's always much more, including more of Kim's interview with Father James Martin. You can also listen to or watch each of our programs. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, Easter music from Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.